So welcome to Concurrent Session 5A, Taking the Lead, Live Product of the Future. A little bit about our presenter today, Yang. I trust many of you know him. Yang currently works in AIA in group pricing, where he responsible for AIA's in-force group life business, and he's very experienced. He has done many presentations for the Institute, even wrote papers about managing disability claims, which came runner-up in the 2011 Aluka Turks Legal Scholarship. He's very grateful today for the opportunity to present, and he strongly believes that actuaries are underrepresented in this area of innovation and be creative about products in life insurance, and we have an important role to play. In terms of hobbies, when he's not busy at work, I don't know when that is.
I don't know when it's the last time.
Yang enjoys travelling with his son, Liam, who is 2.5 years old, around New South Wales countryside, practising his photography and his food critic as a potential career. So without further delay, Yang, please.
Thank you very much. Thank you for coming today. I'm delighted to be able to share this with you. Who's enjoyed the conference so far? Fantastic. I can tell you, because this is my two out of three presentations. I'm getting happier by the minute, and I'll be extremely happy after the 1 o'clock session when my final session is over. The topic today is on innovation. I'll probably go quite quickly through the slides just to share a few ideas, hopefully stimulate a little bit of thinking in this subject. We've had excellent presentations already. Stephen Hubert's presentation on digital disruption was excellent, and there are some things that I'll talk about here, but really it's the discussion that I think I want to get to. This is my second talk, like I said. For those of you who missed my first talk, and really it was about mental health, another serious issue where I feel we need to take the lead. 800,000 suicides every year, in my opinion, is 800,000 too many. When the despair that an individual feels is so great that they'll take their life, I don't think it's an issue that's just in the mind. We need to, I think, take a lead in that area and do something about that. That was the first talk. This is about innovation, but I thought it was worthwhile reiterating that key message from that one. Well, as I think we're all aware, innovation is front page news. David Thodey says, the outgoing CEO of Telstra said, it's the disruptors we worry about. The theme for last night's dinner was innovation. And basically, it's innovate or perish. There was a nice slide in Stephen Hubert's presentation about Kodak. That was not the Kodak moment that probably Kodak envisaged that they would have. I think they were envisaging another Kodak moment, but let's not go through that kind of Kodak moment. So basically, we'll just share a few thoughts about innovation. I'm not an expert. Here along the journey with you, we'll look at some innovations within life insurance, within the industry. I thought we'd take a slightly different look. I'm fascinated by industrial design, and I thought we might see what, you know, can we learn anything from an industrial designer in designing, you know, the products and the services that we have to offer. And then we'll take a brief look at the consumer, and I'm indebted to Mark McCrindle from McCrindle Research, who's a total expert in the area of Gen Y, Gen Alpha, and all those emerging generations younger than me are going to take my job. So, but it's them that we need to think about. And then we'll look at the life product of the future, and then we'll have a bit of discussion. There we go. Steve Jobs, my idol. No, not quite. But that's the iPod. And that, I think, was what first put Apple on the map. Before, of course, the iPad and then the iPhone. And it's made Apple a $700 billion company. Boy, I wish I bought shares when they were a dollar. I wish I bought 10,000 of them. I'd be probably in the Bahamas somewhere then, if I had done that. But, you know, if peace of mind, if that's what we're really offering, many of our missions in our companies will say, you know, we exist so that you can sleep better at night, or we give you peace of mind. I mean, Who here likes, who values peace of mind? And can I have a show of hands? A bit of audience participation. Thank you. Look, if it's such a valuable prize, right, why is it that it's so hard to sell? And I think there are a few issues. We talked about trust in the previous session. We'll come to that. Here's an important quote on innovation that I'd like to call out. Bob McDonald, retired chairman of Procter & Gamble, he said, in America, they talk about quarters, you know, sales quarters. He said, we know from history that while promotion may win quarters, innovation wins decades. And so we need to get onto this, and we need to think about that. But has the life insurance industry innovated at all? Look, I thought, what was life like in the 60s? There's the mod fashion. I don't know what the girls here or the guys think about the fashion. Not bad, huh? That was the political leader we had, you know, Gough Whitlam. This isn't a speech about politics, so I'm not going to make too many comments about that. We all came here, for those of us who came from Sydney and, you know, outside of Melbourne, we Virgin or Qantas, that was what air travel would have looked like back then. That was the latest, waist trimming sort of device back then. They even had curved, curved screens are coming back in. I do see a bit of curvature in that screen there. I do see that curvature. And I think there's something about bedwetting, which was obviously an issue back then. So, just briefly, we all know a lot about it. Just laying something so we can have a discussion going here. What is innovation? Basically, it comes from the Latin words meaning in and novate, which means to introduce something new. I will have a whole list of references at the back, some of these research pieces, so I won't go into all of them. But basically, the experts say that there are different kinds of innovation. So some innovations might be called classified empowering innovations. Innovations that take something that was once costly and makes them available to a lot of people. So the PC was an example of an empowering innovation. I was just having a conversation with someone on the bus on the way back from that wonderful dinner we had. And he was talking about what we really need. He was with a super fund. If we could, what our members need are advice. They need customized solutions. What we need in that area is an empowering innovation that brings down the cost of advice and enables that to be delivered to all the members. So empowering innovations are innovations like that. And then you've got the sustaining innovations where it's more like, in retail, I think a lot of the innovations we see are what they call sustaining ones, where there's a tweak here, the change here. So that's what those people call sustaining innovations. And then finally, you've got efficiency innovations, where it's just about reducing the cost of getting things out. Innovation is easy, right? Okay, so silence means I see Jenny nodding her head in that direction, which in our culture means no. In some cultures it means yes, but in our culture it means no. But there was a very helpful paper. Again, the bibliography is at the end, but Walt Zoltolsky, might be having a cousin of Walt Disney, but he talked about 10 barriers to successful innovation in life insurance. Well, I could read out the 10, but I'm going to turn them into positive statements rather than, it's because of a failure to do this or a failure to do that. I like to be positive. It's Tuesday afternoon. It's Tuesday sort of noon. Let's be positive. So here are the 10 that he called out as what we need to have successful innovation. Firstly, we need to recognize innovation management as a bona fide company function. And I know Tel, for instance, has recognized the value of this, and they have someone maybe with the best title in the whole industry. He's the Chief Innovation and Disruption Officer, the CITO. What a cool title, right? His job is to create disruption. Wow, okay. Secondly and thirdly, we need to position innovation management as separate from product development and separate from continuous improvement. So those things are important, but if we're serious about innovation, we need to call them out separately. Fourthly, we need to define and communicate expectations clearly about the kind of innovation that we want to participate in. For example, in this particular paper, he's categorized them into four different categories. The first one, at level one, is about modifications or additions to existing products. Level two, ideas new to the company, but not new to other companies in the same market. Level three, ideas new in their application to a new market, but not new in other markets. Now, a bit later on, we're going to look at some 10 pretty innovative companies in healthcare. You say, healthcare? Am I in the right? Yeah. I think sometimes we can get our ideas from, you know, what are they doing? So that's the idea of that. Might give us some ideas. And for new to industry ideas, so five, we need to recognize the bias that sales can bring to the process. Isn't this interesting? We often think we need to talk to sales. They're closest to the customer. That's kind of true, isn't it? However, they also have targets. They also have bonuses driven by those, you know, various things. And innovation might actually lead to a short-term reduction. They don't want that. So we need to recognize that. Six, we need to focus our innovation efforts. This is why sometimes the suggestion box, you know, you've had the company's suggestion box. Sometimes that's a great idea, but sometimes the ideas that you get are so diverse that you don't really focus. And we need to focus to get things through. Seventh, it's to make sure that once innovation's efforts are properly staffed with the right people. And I'm going to expand a little bit about that in Innovate with Care, because we find that there are different roles for different personality types within the realm of innovation, right? You might not be the genius guy, 2.5% of the population, who comes up with a new idea, but you might still have a part to play in innovation. And ninth and tenth, we need to recognize innovation management is more than just generating ideas, and we need to evaluate the effectiveness of our innovation. Let's talk about Innovate with Care. So I came across this, I really enjoyed the previous plenary and the diversity of experience that our speakers have had. And in my previous life, in the previous chapter of the current life, I was in a non-profit organization. I was introduced to this tool called Innovating with Care. That's not about being careful. C stands for, some people are creators. Can the 2.5% of the population, of those of you who are creators, please stand up? Yeah, okay, so so there are tools that might help us discover our profile. I am not a creator. I'm doing a talk on innovation. I've never really created anything. I'm sorry. But the A is, that doesn't mean I don't have a part to play, because the A is for an advancer. These are the early adopters, and they are critical as well in the whole innovation process, because they get it, right? Shannon, you know, might create something. I get it. I like it. I go tell everyone about it. Malcolm Gladwell wrote a book called Tipping Point, and some people are salesmen, some people are mavericks. You know, there's a role for different people. Some people are refiners. These guys, many of us may actually be refiners. We are the detailed guys saying, no, have you thought about that? No, no, no. Now, that can be perceived as being negative, but really when we harness that, you know, we're going to need all that refining if it's going to be a great product, right? So there's a role for refiners. And I'm not trying to pigeonhole us all as refiners either. And some people are just executors. They just kind of get the job done. But has there been, we'll talk briefly about, has there been innovation within insurance? Deloitte University Press, good paper. The conservative reputation the industry enjoys has served to camouflage, boy, a tremendous track record. I think we all know that, so I won't spend a lot of time on that. There's a picture of a fire engine. My 2.5-year-old, Liam, likes fire engines. No, he didn't hijack the PowerPoint. No, he didn't get onto this and quietly insert that. But that really, I was fascinated. To learn where fire engines came from. The Great Fire of London in 1666 led to the formation of the fire office. And they started a fire brigade. It's a privately, you know, run by the insurance companies before they handed it over to the municipal authorities. Fascinating. Benjamin Franklin, with one of the founding fathers, when he started his company in the U.S., because of what they did, they instituted home safety inspections. So think of all the social good that these innovations within insurance actually brought to society. It's just amazing. That's Richard Price up there, who was involved with the mortality tables. That was the foundations in the Northampton, and later on the Equitable. There are innovations within life insurance as well. Basically, that research piece talks about how insurance through history has really enabled people to go to be able to take the risk to do business. Insurance is such a vital part in our society. And Tide, I've got a picture of Tide there. It's a soap powder. You think, did that one get snuck into the PowerPoint too? What's the little soap powder box doing there? That's really to say that Tide, Procter & Gamble product, mature product. Some of us might be thinking, goodness, young, talking about all this new stuff, we're a mature market. That was exactly the situation that Tide faced. But after sustained innovation, they managed to double the revenues. It'd been around for 50 years. But after 10 years of focused, systematic effort on innovation, they doubled the revenues from 12 to 24 billion. And, so innovation is also possible for mature markets. But what about life insurance and innovation and life insurance in Australia? Possibly the greatest innovation that Australia has created. I know I liked it, Vegemite. But just briefly, there have been obviously product changes, which we've gone from whole of life to unbundled products. There have been changes in the way that that our distribution models have changed as we've evolved to find ways to better connect with our customers. So we used to have Tide agents and multi-agents and then IFAs. Look, the whole group market, when the platform of superannuation was there, we innovated and we saw an opportunity in group insurance. And despite the wars, I want to fly the flag for group insurance, not because I'm in group insurance, but because I would argue that, look, it's probably been the thing that is the innovation that has contributed the most to their underinsurance problem. Anthony, hi. We've got to get the pricing right. Yeah, we're innovating, right? But seriously, I think one of the speakers said, when he's handed the check, goodness, I mean, we're collecting $4 billion in premium. We're paying 85% more in claims. We're making a difference. We're making a difference. That was sort of the main piece. Now, this is where it gets here. I'm not going to talk much about technology because I think Stephen did a great job. I am going to talk about some advances in healthcare and the one in mental health. I encourage you to download that presentation if you missed it. There's a lot of references in there. And I'll come out and do a presentation if you're really interested in the area. But the 10 most innovative healthcare companies in 2015 called up by this Fast Company article. The first one is called Apricot Forest. And it serves 25% of China's 2.5 million doctors use one of their three apps which have to deal with either client management or they've got a journal type thing which gives doctors access to journals and to research. The second company is called Perfint. It's India-based and robotic image-guided robotics for cancer surgery. The third one is a company based in the States called Umada Health, and it provides personal health coaches, and companies like Humana and Kaiser Permanente, use these personal coaches from Umada, and that's making a difference in the lives of their members. Alminda, a fascinating Israel-based company. Why are the Jews so smart, yeah? If an MRI can show you the map of the brain like a map, on Google Maps, you can see in some applications, you can see where the traffic is. Alminda's product allows us to see the activity of the brain. So the neurons firing when we think, talk, sleep, and do various things. And this apparently has tremendous implications for the 2 billion people who suffer from Alzheimer's, Parkinson's, and those, neurodegenerative type diseases. Amazing. CardioMEMS, a million hospitalizations in the US every year because of heart sort of things. CardioMEMS has developed a paper-sized wireless clip that's planted in the body. It helps doctors to monitor what's going on and react a lot faster. Organovo, who's here? Who has a 3D digital printer at home? Christmas is coming up. I wouldn't mind one, just saying. Organovo is like 3D printing for organs. So its application is in drug trials in various other things. So rather than subjecting us poor people to these drug trials, we can now test the effects of some of these drugs in these organs that have been created by Organovo. Amazing. Theranos. And that's that blonde. She is a bit blonde, I think. Amazing. I have such, you know, when I read her story, I was saying, far out young. Well, why? Stanford dropout. She was inspired by her grandfather, who was a surgeon and an inventor. And she's holding a nano vial tube of blood. She didn't like, anyone here like needles? Okay, right. She didn't like pain. She said, there's got to be a better way, right? Developed a way to get your blood from a chemist, get your result back in 4 hours, can run 70 tests on that nanotube, and the cost of that test is $2 to $3, whereas the cost of getting, you know, when we go to Douglas Moore or wherever we go to, you know, they take a lot of blood, you know, and it takes some days and so on. So when she floated the stock, right, of which she owns 50% in Theranos, it was valued at $9 billion. So she's America's youngest, amazing. Well done. There's Google, Zenefits, and Cohealo. Just touch on Cohealo. Just like Airbnb monetized unused accommodation space, and Uber monetized unused car capacity. So Cohealo is a company that's monetizing unused surgical equipment because, you know, a surgical table costs $50,000. You know, all these pieces are expensive. So Cohealo, kind of think of it that way. They found a way to track unused activity and to do that. Obviously, wearable technology, AI vitality, finding a way to, promote fitness and reward people for that. Virtual reality treatments, that was a throwback to the mental health talk, where virtual reality is being used with great effect for PTSD. Right, that's Dieter Rams. I'm sure you all know that because you probably have a poster of him on your bedroom. No? Okay. Fine, that's okay, I don't. So Dieter Rams was an industrial designer, famous for his contribution in Braun Electronics, was a bit of an inspiration for Johnny Ives from Apple as well. So he came up with, he's probably best known for his statement, less is more, which is, but he came up with his 10 principles, which we'll just quickly run through and then think about how they might apply to insurance. So firstly, he felt that good design has to be innovative. In other words, I think another way of saying it, it's clever, it's something new, it adds value. Two, it makes a product useful. It's got to be functional. Functional design, Scandinavian functional design. Thirdly, it's aesthetic. It's beautiful. It's something that brings you pleasure when you look at it. Imagine a beautiful PDS that gives you... Okay. Let's not push it too far. Four, makes the product understandable. I think we all get that. We can do far more to make our products more understandable, can't we? Five, it's unobtrusive. I like this. It's humble. It sort of takes second place. It's not standing up saying, take a look at me. It's saying, you know, enjoy what I can do, but, you know, not trying to take center stage. That's a good one. Six is honest. And I think this is about the trust issue. So honesty to me means that it's what you see is what you get. The product has integrity. It means that when I think it will pay me for this, when I need it over then, it will do that, right? Seventhly, it's long-lasting. Can we design products that are robust? Eighth, it's thorough down to the last detail. This means taking care of the tiny details to really make the user experience and, you know, of our products as good as it can be. Nine, is it environmentally friendly? And I think about it talks about stewardship, it talks about an intergenerational responsibility, thinking beyond the current generation. Can we design things in that way? And 10 is as little design as possible, less is more. Look at the quote that he gave, that he says, you cannot understand good design if you do not understand people. Fundamentally, isn't this what really it's all about? It's for people. It's trying to make things easier, better, to connect better with people. Well, how might this play out for life insurance? So I think, you know, innovative, we've talked briefly about that. I think we can come to that. Let's look at the consumer. I'm indebted a lot to Mark McCrindle for some of these slides. Obviously, currently the main consumers of life insurance are in Gen X, 35 to 50 year olds, because this is where they have the liabilities and the dependents. But that will soon shift to Gen Y. So how can we? And they're different. There, it's a digital generation. They're used to, and we've got a few slides that show you different things. How can we connect with them? Bain and Company, the balance of power has been shifting to the consumer as a result of rapid adoption of smart mobile devices. The information has shifted to the consumer. I won't belabor this point. I think we all know this. Let's get on to the discussion. But I think that man with the shaver might hold the clue to how we connect with Gen Y. He's saying, what in the world? How can we do that? So that's a story of Gillette Guard, another Procter & Gamble story, because that was one of the sort of research pieces that I relied on. And it's a story of how, Gillette used to sell these double razor blades. But through countless hours of research, they found that a lot of these men don't have access to, bathroom-type facilities, and, water's a bit hard to come by. The stubble grows a bit longer. It's pretty hard for me. I'm very happy if I can... I'm challenged in that area, sorry, you gotta have a few laughs along the way. They found that a single razor was actually more effective, and so I'm not suggesting we sell razors to Gen Y, but that came about because of hours of research, hours of really trying to understand their clientele. I think that's what we'll need to do with Gen Y, because it's changing. Because when I was growing up, look, there used to be three stages. It was, I was a child, and then I became a teenager, and I think I've become an adult, though some would disagree with that. Or maybe I'm a kipper or a young adult. That's wishful thinking. But, since life has become, not only just these three, but there's a tween now between the children and the teenager. There's young adults and kippers looking cool. There's down ages, there's career changes. So things are changing. And the consumer of tomorrow, are we headed into a sort of a post-literate generation? So look at the amount of screen time that is there versus face-to-face time. Look at, on the other one, if Facebook was a nation, 1.4 billion people, it's got more users in China. So are we becoming post-literate, We're definitely becoming post-linear. Look at the bottom sort of that corner, and we used to have very clear-cut traditional pathways, home and school or TAFE, and then a job, etc. But these days, look at the mobility that we're having: 17 jobs, 5 careers, 15 homes, and look at the educational pathway difference. 9 to 5 also. What's 9 to 5? And are we also now sort of post-logical? This is the age of big data, but, IBM quote, 2.5 quintillion bytes of data created every day. And that was probably a few years ago, so it's probably more now. So with this amount of data, can we sort of getting to the point where there's just so much, it's almost post-logical. So there we go. The life product of the future. I hope you're not completely disappointed. There's no magic silver bullet, but I do have 5 suggestions. There are experts within this room. Let's have a discussion. I know you know far more than me, but I think it might have something to do with being omnichannel, because we're used to being engaged in the ways that we want to be engaged in. So I think it's got to be omnichannel. Secondly, I think that there's so much data that, say, Westpac knows about me because I bank with them, if they wanted to sell me something, can they use their data so that I don't have to fill that many forms, you know? Can I be known? Can I be known, right? Thirdly, I think, you know, I want to be able to customize it. Sorry, I don't know whether any of you like Burberry jackets, but this is not a complete outright promotion of Burberry, but that's a Burberry jacket. And you can, you know, choose the, you know, different buttons, belts, and so on. That was my picture for mass customization. Fourthly, it has to, I think, align with our values. I think we're going, you know, as a society in general, Maslow's hierarchy of human, you know, the need, we're moving more into values and so on. And that's why I put the child sponsorship, again, not an ad for child sponsorship, but I think we are looking for organizations that say, that align with our values, what we think are important, what we stand for. And finally, you know, I was having a chat, I think, was it with you? I said, you know, why do we buy certain brands, right? Why do we, and sometimes we may buy certain brands because in the end, it's sort of saying something about us. And so the challenge for us is, can we maybe be the kind of company that will, you know, resonate with our customers in that way? Conclusion and discussion, I think it's innovate or perish. We don't want to have a Kodak moment in that sense. And how shall we act? I think there is every opportunity for us to continue to engage more in the field of innovation. And I think the challenge that I'd like to present to all of us is, how will we do this? Thank you very much. So just some of the references later on, for so they're available. Is it on?
Can you hear me? Okay. That was very enthusiastic and passionate delivery.
Thank
you. So we do have about 20 minutes for questions. So
if I didn't want to keep it sort of, so we can have more time.
Okay. So any questions? Any keen volunteers to start up? We've got 20 minutes.
We can all go home early.
Well,
sorry.
I'll start. So you had two slides about the 10 principles.
Yes.
From Dieter Rams.
Yes.
About good designs.
Yep.
You know, about it's innovative, is the product useful, is it understandable,
yep.
Is it long-lasting. Like, how practical is that we can apply that to, you know, life insurance? I noticed, you know, profitability is not mentioned there.
Right. Obviously, I think it has to also be profitable. Otherwise, we're just not going to get capital to keep doing that. So, but I tended to focus more on the consumer aspect, right? So I think what you've said is completely true. We need to do all these things and find a way to make it profitable as well. It might be worthwhile, since we do have a bit of extra time, right, to maybe just dwell a little on this to see if it stimulates some discussion. And again, you know, I'm not imposing this. This is just food for thought. You know, maybe things we can learn from an industrial designer. So, innovative. So we've certainly seen innovations in product design, definitions. We've seen technology such as expert underwriting, reflexive underwriting. But are we doing enough, right? So there's telematics. And by the way, feel free also, if you're aware of innovations, right, that you've come across, to just, you don't have to pose a question, share this with the, we're a sharing economy, share this with the group, please. Secondly, so we talked about useful. Obviously, our products are useful, but is the challenge here perhaps, you know, if you buy a beautiful chair or you have an iPod or some physical object, obviously its presence is just there. You're reminded by it. But how can we perhaps remind our customers of what they have without being obtrusive? Aesthetic. Can we introduce beauty into the user experience? A bit out there, but anyway. 4, understandable. Again, have we done enough to make our products as understandable as they can be? And that's a challenge. We need to get out the detail. Again, honesty. It's about, you know, how do we create confidence? How can we create that confidence in them? Long lasting. How do we design for robustness? Thorough, you know, environmentally friendly. So, and I think this is where we are, for instance, in the group space. I don't think it's just about designing a product that pays, but by engaging with our claimants, you know, you could argue that we're trying to make, we're trying to return them back to work. So we're trying to make the process more efficient and more environmentally sustainable rather than simply throwing dollars at the claim. That was the point of that. So how can we think about claims potentially or, you know, other aspects of the product that way?
Thank you.
Yep, thank you. I think the organizers prefer that.
David Morris. I've got a thing about life insurance these days, and you said at the start it was all about giving peace of mind. And I think one of the best innovations we could make is actually to get back to the basics of actually doing that, because I've just clocked up 50 years in life insurance. And I think there's only been two product innovations in that time. One was going to unit linked, and the other one was critical illness. And I think since then, we've spent a good deal of time and ingenuity on the financial engineering to get away and actually make those products much more complicated. We've passed most of the risk back to the consumer. Through YRT, through Unit Link, they've got the investment risk, they've got the expense risk. You don't know what you're actually buying because the premium can change. What's the peace of mind in that?
Hmm. Thank you. Yeah. Good comment. So, yeah. Have we overcomplicated things? Have we gone away from the basics? Less is more. Food for thought. Anthony.
Yeah, Anthony Bryan. I guess two thoughts I've got. One has to do with in the direct marketing space, and the innovation we've seen with funeral insurance has taken a long time for ASIC to undo, for the individuals not really understanding, again, this idea of getting back to basics. And I guess my view from my background is to be a good product development actuary, you have to be cynical. You not only think about what's the benefit design that's appropriate for a customer's need, but how can that benefit design be abused? Because if you look in group insurance at the moment, the claims experience for those people who are opting up to maximum cover under AAL as opposed to just taking default cover is substantially different, and you're introducing moral hazard and anti-selection and these sorts of things, which is, you know, life insurance is meant to be utmost good faith, and we're dealing in an environment where there is increasing information asymmetry. People can know more about their own health than is publicly available, and it can be very hard to discover what a person knows about their health and are they selecting against the office. So how do you encourage that disclosure and honesty and sharing and price fairly the risks for each individual and deal with these people who are trying to game the system?
Thank you, Anthony. And I think that is, you know, being thorough, thinking things through possibly touches, you know, is a principle that touches on that. Definitely agree. We've seen problems with the group insurance market. And my take on why that happened was because we copied a product that was designed for corporate insurance, corporate standalone schemes, right? Brought it across to this sort of this new environment, threw it open to industry super funds. But of course, the environment is not exactly the same. To join a corporate super scheme, you had to be employed by that. You know, there were various other checks and so on. And so by transplanting something from one environment into another, we didn't. It was like introducing a species of you know, bird or whatever to a new environment, and not really understanding the environmental, you know, collateral damage that would happen as a result of that, which we are now trying to address and recover from. So I think definitely also, along the way to the perfect product, yeah, there's some stumbles clearly along the way. Adam and then John.
Helly Young, thanks very much for your presentation. Adam Stoltz, AIA. I suppose just a couple of reflections on myself. I think one of the themes, especially from this morning's plenary, was in terms of where actuaries can give a contribution into this space. And I suppose for me, when I go through the list of the 10 principles, two that jump out to me, at least, is number 7, long-lasting, and number 10, which I'll summarise as simplicity. In terms of the long-lasting aspect, I suppose I've been working internationally and I've come to Australia, and I see a market that seems to be very short-term focused in terms of the sales practices and the general structure of the industry. Mm. And I think innovation and the context is quite challenging, because everyone tells you the reasons as to why we can't do this because of so-and-so. And I think as actuaries we have a role that we need to push through that. Mm-hmm. If we see something that is for the good of the long term and to be more sustainable, it's not easy to put through, and there might be a dip in sales in the short term, but we have to be persistent about that if we really believe in it. So I think that's one way we need courage, and we can make a difference. In terms of simplicity, in a previous role, the chairman of our company said something which struck me, which was that he thought innovation was a dirty word. And because if you say be innovative to a group of smart people, they'll do their best to make the most complex solution possible,
right.
And they'll define innovation by the level of complexity.
Right.
And so his paradigm was that innovation should not be measured by complexity, innovation should be managed by how simple it is. And I think that's a lesson that we as actuaries can take in terms of how we approach things or give recommendations is what can we do to be simple. And I think this goes to the theme that was said before in terms of getting back to basics, and I think to some extent you can see a link. If the simpler things may be the longest lasting. The complex ones are the more difficult to manage, more difficult to understand. So anyway, that's my two cents in terms of how I think actuaries can contribute.
No, thank you. Yep. Very true. Agree. John?
John Dodsworth from Suncorp. Thanks, Young. That was a really good paper, very thought-provoking. Just to what the previous speaker said, 2 cents worth, I'll give 1 cent worth. Just point three there, the Dieter Rams's principles were very thought-provoking for me. I guess he works in an area where the things he produces are tangible, whereas insurance is an extremely intangible transaction, really. Mm. But I think point three, aesthetic, you can probably translate that. Aesthetic is something that is inherently tangible, I think, but to an intangible, you could probably translate that to pride of ownership. What would make people feel proud that they've got this insurance product, that they feel they belong to something that's a good thing, a noble thing? Trevor Matthews, the noble purpose of insurance, I think he used that phrase earlier this morning. Can we regenerate that sense of feeling, that sense of pride of being part of a noble purpose? But yet we're designing insurance products, for instance, a stepped premium insurance product where effectively once you get past 50, you know, you find your premium rates becoming increasingly difficult to service. So there's not a real sense of belonging. Years ago, I once worked for one of the big mutual companies, and you saw that there were people who had held their policies for 30 or 40 years, and they were people of very modest background. And yet I got the impression those people looked on their insurance policy as a centrepiece for their financial stability throughout life. Mm. I don't think that attitude exists anymore. Mm. So I'm wondering, how can we design products that capture this pride of ownership, this sense of being part of a good, noble thing? And maybe it's these product designs that encourage people to keep their policy. Mm. And escalating step premium rates probably is not the way to go. So, you know, we could start looking at things like that. Mm-hmm. Anyway, that's...
Thank you. And the previous speakers, I think, talked about exactly what you've just said, how, you know, And then that's loss of trust. So how do we work to restore it? I think I've got a question there from the lady. Yeah.
Hi, I'm Farah from the Malaysian Regulator. In our market, our distribution channel is widely dominated by agents. And one of our strategic objectives is actually to diversify this. We're trying to push the industry to use more financial advisors, use the internet and all that, but we're getting a lot of resistance from the agency force. So right. Maybe can you share a bit on the Australian experience on, in transitioning in terms of distribution channels?
Right. Okay, big topic. I think we got our own issues, right, about the independence of advice. I think obviously you'd get more independence of advice if you moved from a tied agency structure, and if that was one of the objectives, then you know certainly. But as we've discovered in Australia, how independent really is independent? It's a complex issue. I don't think I can do much more here, except to maybe to say that, and we can take that offline. It's a big area. Yeah. And there have been new legislations around, you know, disclosure around conflict of remuneration, because you know it's not a simple one to solve.
Hi, I'm Jill Withers from Zurich.
Hi, Jill.
Hi. One of the points you had up there was simplicity, and I think this has been mentioned before in the conference, but our products, particularly things like disability income, for example, has become just so complicated, and our PDSs are now hundreds of pages long.
Yeah.
So consumer's point of view, you know, it's our products are anything but understandable. We have so many bells and whistles, you know, sort of, you know, day one disability and all that sort of stuff.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
It's just, I think we kind of lose sight of the main reason why people are buying these products, and they're just way too complex that the average person just doesn't understand them.
Thank you, Jill. Isn't there a bit of a consistent theme coming through here? It's, guys, you know, it's like the coach that says, here's a ball, that's the goal, right? This is the game. And it's almost like I hear a theme, you know, it's not me, obviously, it's you speaking, a return to basics, a return to honesty. What is it really all about? You know, what is the essential proposition? And being true and clear to that. Do you have time for one more question, or
yeah?
More any other comments and questions?
Last words, yeah.
Go forth and innovate. Back to simplicity. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.